Okay, I could call that a constant current antenna if I set it up just right. It would appear to be almost constant current along that length. If you study a end-fired collinear antenna, the so-called station master antenna, although it physically looks a little bit different without the radome over it, electronically it's got a lot of similarity. In the case of a station master-like vertical collinear, you have a whole bunch of half wavelength pieces of semi-rigid cable, half wavelength electronically, even though mechanically they're a little bit shorter, and there's a crisscross of center conductor and shield at each intersection. You put about the 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 of those sections together, you end up what's called a pancake pattern. It really is a vertical collinear. It's as if you had a whole bunch of dipoles vertically stacked with the individual feed lines to each dipole. Let me drop.
Can I ask a favor?
Okay, I heard a lot of feedback, and I think that was Eric. You got a message for us, Eric? KE2EJ, K2LIW.
Yeah, do me for the next. Do me a favor, for the next 2 minutes, transmit on
3 on the eastern input. Okay. I'll transmit on the eastern input. I got my antenna aimed in the wrong direction right now, so I'm going to be a little bit noisy. But hopefully you guys will be able to hear me. The collinear antenna, the station master-like antenna, does give you a pancake-like pattern because it's got a lot of real estate vertical, therefore it's going to have a vertical mean width that is very narrow. And so there are various antennas you can see in the JASIC Antenna Engineering Handbook that are either built like the station master with individual pieces of semi-rigid cable is one way of doing it. Another way of doing it is with a distribution of inductors and capacitors along the length of the wire, so to speak, with a method of supporting them. So there are multiple ways of electronically making a collinear antenna. It really looks like multiple vertically stacked dipoles. That's what I think this thing might be that you're describing. And once you know the total length of the antenna, and if you have reason to believe that the current near the tip is similar to the current near the beginning, then the antenna pattern, as is the pancake antenna pattern, is reasonably predictable. Back to you, Rich. WB2 Golf X-ray Mike, K2LIW in the TechNet.
GXM, Rich, this is, it's actually, it's a, Dick, I need to disappear for about 2 minutes. Sorry about that, WB2GXM.
Very fine. I'm going to do an experiment here. Okay. Looks like there's a way I can aim my antenna a little bit better. And so I'll get a little more signal to the repeater.
Max, you're done.
You said you're done, Eric, and I can go back to the normal operation?
Yes, you can, Dick.
Okay, and the normal operation gives me quite a bit more signal into into that repeater. All right. While we're waiting, let's see if Rich has come back. Okay, here we go. Joe, WA2RYY. Okay, are you still there, Joe? K2RYW in the TechNet.
Why, yes. Yes, I am.
Yeah, we called you a little bit earlier. You apparently were away from the mic. Why don't you go ahead right now with your question while we're asking, while we are waiting for Rich to come back. You got it, Joe.
Well, perhaps you could put me on the list for next week, and that'll take care of that. That way it'll allow a little more time for a discussion on a particular subject.
Now, don't worry about it, Joe. I'll fire away with your question right now.
Okay. I made you YY here. How would you determine the approximate signal sensitivity of a digital television converter? That's your question for this week. Unless you want to carry it over to next week.
Yeah, I'd first turn it over to Eric. Because under normal circumstances, but an analog television set. I could put in nothing but a dead carrier, slowly make the carrier weaker and weaker. I would eventually see a certain amount of snow on the screen. And although it's not an exact number, to the nearest few decibels, which in many cases is good enough, I could tell you where the sensitivity is. In the case of digital television, the whole system is looking for a very specific digital signature of that video and audio and other kinds of information being transmitted. And so the whole system gives you no response at all, per se. There is a catch to that, though. And that is, at least on my digital television converter, there's a mode I can put it into where I asked for a signal strength indicator. And once I request that mode, what's unique about that mode compared to all other modes is it does not time out. And so it gives me a bar chart telling me carrier strength, I believe. Although here I'm not sure. It might also really be bit error rate of the digital-like signal. So whether or not that signal strength mode with the bar chart that hangs there forever, whether or not that would respond to a simple CW signal from a service monitor, it won't. I think Eric is telling me it won't. Okay. Eric, if you wanted to measure the sensitivity of a digital television converter, how would you go about doing it? Yeah, I know you. You've got a fancy television signal generator.
Hiding from my brother.
I could plug it in. So how would you do it, Eric? KE2EJ, K2IW.
Ah, silly kind of simple. You can make your spectrum analyzer go into DBMV and it'll be the same as the rest of the world. And what you do is take in attenuated. Now that far meter that you see, actually the two type meters, from zero probably to like 40 or 45%, it's really the IFSC. After that, it's error. The higher that thing gets, the lower the error. Anyway, you just back off the signal until you start to see it block out, and then head back the other way. Measure how much signal you're going into it. That's usable carrier to noise. That's where you actually can watch TV. KYWK2J.
Okay, now back up here a little bit, Eric. You told me that bar, the upper section of that bar chart for signal strength really is bit error rate. The lower section of that bar chart, you told me, is automatic gain control of the IF strip. So if I'm putting in a dead carrier at the right frequency, and I look at just that function of that bar, that
but it won't tell you where the threshold of good signal is.
Okay, but can I get a hint from that? If I know that the AGC is the first third of the bar, I've got a section that's red, I've got a section that's yellow, I've got a section that's green, I've got a number that goes from 0 to 100 or something like that. If I'm just raising the red bar from literally 0 up to that end of the red bar, and I know that the way my digital television works, I get some amount of demodulation at the top of the red bar at the beginning of the yellow. Most of the time the audio is dropped out, but the video will be there a significant percentage of the time. And because the actual digital television goes from above threshold to below threshold at approximately 1 decibel of signal strength change, I'd like to believe that just a pure dead carrier raising me as far as the red bar will go, won't that give me a hint as to whether or not my demodulator has a sensitivity of 10 microvolts or 1 microvolt? Over to you, Eric. KE2EJ, KQLAW.
Now, the answer to your question is really sort of yes and no. Depending upon whom the manufacturer is and how they decided to derive the voltages that are being sent to the computer to be displayed on the screen. Some manufacturers actually have a zone where they cross over with it. Actually, they're still looking at the AGC, but they're also looking at bit error rate in a small overlap area. What you're calling a 1 dB difference can be more than that, can be like a 3 dB difference, because you do have all this nice error correction going on. And it's when the error correction finally fails that you transition out. And that failure point can be changed by different things, by the actual quality of the edges of the signal, the symbols themselves,
the actual ability of the TELUS and the Turby to put the thing back together in its original form, the amount of jitter that there might have be happening based upon whatever the transmitter was doing, and multipath and what other little bitties that you have that you can throw into the mix. So, there's a range. If you're going to put it into numbers, let's say it would go from like 40 to 60%, which is kind of like a fuzzy unknown area.
So, assuming that Joe owns a reasonable variable attenuator, and he sets up his television receiving antenna aimed at Empire State Building, and he adjusts that variable attenuator until his known converter hits dropout, then he takes the unknown converter and repeats the test. He can do a side-by-side comparison test, a kind of a shootout. Neither one is going to give him an answer in dBm, which is what he really wants. And so he can find out which one is better or which one is worse, how many dB better or worse, but still, where the absolute value is a little bit mysterious. What you're saying is that crank it until the converter no longer responds, then take that signal into something like a spectrum analyzer, which is set up for a known resolution bandwidth at the right frequency region. By looking at that screen, measuring the pilot tone and so on, I imagine you can come up with an approximation. But now here's a catch, and that is almost every spectrum analyzer that has reasonable flat performance.
Thinking like a scientist, will you please? Think like a cable guy that's got a little stupid averaging meter that just basically nothing more than a tuned circuit and a dial.
Okay, so you can buy a piece of inexpensive test equipment that people doing field installations might be able to use. I was about to tell you that to use the spectrum analyzer is a problem, because almost every self-respecting spectrum analyzer in the original design has got two choices. You can either make it very flat across the frequency response, similar sensitivity or similar noise figure across the frequency response, or you can make it very sensitive and very non-flat. Almost all of them have chosen flat. The bottom line is that almost every spectrum analyzer you can buy has a front-end noise figure of around 35 dB. So unless you put a preamplifier, 20 or 30 decibels at least of preamplifier, in front of a spectrum analyzer, it's a good, leveled instrument with absolute power, but it's dead as a doornail, and when it comes to front-end sensitivity. This piece of test equipment you're buying, you're describing now, is that built by the Weinschel or some other company that makes inexpensive test equipment? Who makes this piece of test equipment you just described for digital television, and roughly how many dollars? KE2EJ, KE2RIW?
Okay, let me stop you right here now. When you were fixing TV sets, analog TV sets, what was an acceptable level? And by the way, the standard that was used was dBmV, right? 1,000 millivolts? What is an acceptable input level for a snow-free picture in dBmV, Dick?
I can give you an answer to the nearest fraction of a dB after a calculation, because I live in a different world. I live in the world of 1 megahertz resolution bandwidth. In other words, with a 1 meg resolution bandwidth, a 0 dB noise figure preamplifier produces an amount of noise of exactly minus 114 dBm per megahertz. So in that world, I now have to go over to a 6 meg noise equivalent bandwidth and convert millivolts and convert the milliwatts of power into millivolts of voltage. So I got to do a number of conversions. I don't live in that world. So a few minutes from now, I could give you an answer. But why don't you give me an answer right now of how many dBmV, and by the way, is that positive or negative dBmV, is the sensitivity of a good television front end? In the analog day, a hot front end, I think, had around 5 or 6 dB noise figure. KE2EJ, KQRIW.
All right, I'm going to help you, Susie. Okay, we're going to use dBmV. And actually, a good sensitive tuner, really good tuner, is just sort of like a little better than minus 20, ain't much better. if you were a cable guy, your goal was to either get plus 10 or 0 dBm at the tap in the house, is where the converter is. So 0 dBmV. That's a lot of juice. We're not talking microvolts here. So, you know, you can take some of those ideas and just throw them out the window.
And although there's a little bit of a conversion factor because television systems, cable systems are 70 ohm transmission line versus the 50 ohm transmission line of the rest of the United States, there's a little bit of a conversion there. And 1 microvolt is minus 107 dBm. 1 millivolt is 60 decibels stronger. It's 30 to 1 ratio in voltage, which is a 1,000,001 ratio in power. 60 dB stronger than minus 107. Let me think about that now. If it was 100, it was minus 40, minus 47. So a millivolt on a 50 ohm system is minus 47 dBm. On a 70 ohm system, it's going to be just a little bit shy of that. Am I in the right ballpark, Eric? K2EJ, K2LIW.
As you usually say, get the medicine. Yes, it is a different world. But when we think about sensitivity of a radio, we normally think, either you think in dBm, you get down to, you know, minus 120, minus 150 in that neighborhood, maybe minus 125 if you're that lucky. Or you think in microvolts, you know, a quarter of a microvolt, half a microvolt. This is like light years away from the minimum signal required to make a television picture across 6 megahertz.
Now, the gold standard for cable TV installations in a private home are around 0 dBmV. However, I've heard of a few people who run into brand X television set where 0 dBmV into the front end of a hot set, it is such an extremely strong signal, capable of 50 dB of signal-to-noise ratio, of carrier-to-noise ratio, so to speak, that some television sets run out of automatic gain control range at 0 dBmV. Or I guess occasionally they hit numbers like plus 5 and plus 10, 0 dBmV.
Years ago you're talking about.
There have been people who complained about running out of dynamic range on the high end because the cable TV was developing a signal too strong for their set and they had to put in an attenuator. Maybe it doesn't happen very often, but it used to, Eric. KE2EJ, K2LIW.
Now, as I said previously, the cable installer's goal is to get 0 dBm at the tap. A lot of times, you know, they'll be coming out of the line extender, plus 30. The guy doesn't have to have it, 20 dB pad, you know, and they'll deliver 20 dBm at the tap, and they'll just tell it through. So, you know, it tells the mixer to pick up everything all at the same time.
If you put plus 20 dBmV into a TV set, I suspect you're getting relatively close to the point where your front end is now going into a kind of overload. It's going to be developing into modulation distortion. Therefore, you might, as you just said, see more than one television signal at the same time. In the analog world, you'll see some funny ghosts. Is that sort of true, Eric? KE2EJ, K2IW?
No, it's very true. That's why a lot of cable guys still don't persist, they don't there's a lot that goes with the cable. Now that the trunk system has gone fiber, it makes some of it easier, but they still don't get the concept of the line extenders. Having tilt on the line to compensate for the cable, but now cable vision, they come out of the trunks as analog, go through a conventional line extender amplifier, and they go through regular coax to describe it. So, you know, there's stuff there that you used to have to think about. They don't think about it so much anymore.
Yeah, a number of the smart electronic people I talk to from time to time tell me about the fact that many a company will try to hire the lowest denominator if possible, lowest common denominator. In other words, you try to get a person that's just barely smart enough to do the work, but not somebody that's super smart. We have to pay them a whole lot of money, and therefore, an awful lot of the equipment really has red lights and green lights on it, and these people wear a shirt saying that green is good and red is bad. And sometimes you run into situations where a guy comes through to do an installation, do some troubleshooting, he sees some red lights, he replaces that module, and a day later, they're still complaining about there's a red light, and they replace that module, and it goes on and on and on. Keep replacing that module as opposed to finding out really what's going on. The red light may not indicate a failure of the module. It may be a failure of the signal that's going into the module due to some other factor. So when it comes to that piece of inexpensive test equipment that you were starting to describe to us, Eric, who manufactures it, what brand name, how many dollars for something that can measure roughly the signal strength of a digital over-the-air television signal? Does anybody manufacture an inexpensive piece of signal strength indicator like that, that you know of? KE2EJ, K2LIW.
KE2LIW, KE2EJ, I have many. There are many from really cheap to really expensive and accurate. You got companies like Hewlett-Packard that make expensive ones specifically for the cable industry in the portable form, with built-in sleep savers. There used to be a company called Gerald that was General Instruments that became Motorola, that became some other Chinese company now. A company called Dawn, a little satellite company. They make a cheap version. There's a lot of them out there. Chinese make cheapy ones, $60 or $100, $120. They're called field strength meters.
Okay, I think you're telling me I might be able to buy an acceptable accuracy field strength meter for digital over-the-air television.
For both. Analog and digital.
Okay. So it specifically will measure a digital television, which has got some rather different characteristics from analog. But I can get within a couple of decibels, a dBm or dBmV, of accuracy. So are you telling me for $120, if I go to what used to be called Gerald, or what is now called Dawn, another company, would I be able to buy for $120 a moderate accuracy field strength meter? Over to you, Eric, K2LIW.
Yes, you'll be able to get a cheapy meter that speaks Chinglish. And then once you get past the part of being able to turn it on and find out what channel you're interested in, you'll actually be able to read how much this stuff there is in the DDMV. Might even speak it to you. Yeah, there's really cheap low-end stuff for, quick cable installers, what knows, nothing yet. The really high-end pieces. Designed for that industry. The cable companies got to get their stuff from somewhere. They get them from companies that manufacture the amplifiers, even the connectors that they put up on the poles. It's a complete thing. So you have a lot of installers. You may not have so many cable companies, but you will have a lot of people who need these instruments. So there's quite a bit of them out there.
Okay, now here's the bottom line question, Eric. Joe already owns a reasonably good, traceable to the Bureau, IFR brand name service monitor, which has a spectrum analyzer mode and a moderately good sensitivity receiver. If you were in Joe's shoes and you had that piece of test equipment rolling right now and you wanted to make within a couple of dB, 2 or 3 dB of accuracy, 4 dB of accuracy, of signal strength, of threshold, of a digital over-the-air.
I give you the proceed.
Okay, would you go out and buy this signal strength meter, or would you use some real smart ham radio intuition?
I give you the precision.
Ingenuity. All right, so you're going to use some good ingenuity, ham radio ingenuity, with that IFR traceable to the Bureau. Over to you, Eric, K2LIW. Think like Joe.
He's not going to do that.
For me, it's simple. Okay. Just so happens you need a device which has a F connector in it, an F connector out, and a whole bunch of switches in between them. One that says 1 dB, another one that says 3 dB, another one that says 6 dB, so on and so forth. You know what I'm talking about. A switchable attenuator. Now I need a TV set that I'm measuring. Okay? And just for the heck of it, I happen to have channel 2, which is on channel 33 or 32, actually, if they happen to be transmitting from the World Trade Center. And I know that there is a signal there. I can actually hook my IFR to it and see it there. And actually, I might actually want to look and see what the maximum signal strength I would get out of it. We it's going to be in DBM. It ain't going to be in DBMV, so I'm going to take my computer, and I'm going to bring up the DBM to DBMV calculator, because I happen to have a list of what the sensitivity is supposed to be as measured by the Sarnoff lab, or this lab, or that lab, because all of these things have been previously tested. I'm going to say, okay, let's look at this on the spectrum display of the IFR. Okay, we don't even have to care what the resolution bandwidth is. We're just going to look at the average of this line, and we're going to measure it in DBM. We're going to convert it to DBMV thanks to this wonderful little computer program that we have. Now, we're going to stick that signal into the attenuator. We're going to stick the attenuator into the receiver that we're testing. We're going to tune to channel 33 with all of these switches in the off position so that we're getting the full signal out of this attenuator. We're going to start kicking attenuators and so we start seeing some blocking in the picture. We hear a little bit of crackling in the audio. And we're just going to take that last dB or that last 2 dB out, the 2 dB out, and we're going to read what the switches say, and we're going to subtract that from the maximum signal that we measured, and we now know what the minimum sensitivity of that receiver is.
I like that. Assuming that he's got a good over-the-air broadcast television aerial with essentially line of sight to Empire, which means he's getting a good strong signal, hopefully that signal going through that K brand name step attenuator in the 0 dB mode, 0 dB of attenuation mode, is significantly above the threshold of his IFR. His IFR gives him a dBm, dB with reference to a milliwatt reading with its particular IF bandwidth, which he might know about, and then he's got a standard to go from, and now X number of dB of attenuation when that system is hooked up to the unknown digital television receiver, and you subtract those dBs from the first reading of the IFR, and you've got a number. Wonder if you need any further fill on that, Eric. Joe, that seems like a possible way to go. I wonder if I know you, you've already had your IFR on that television aerial of yours, looking at what there, yes, you've given us lots of information. You've looked with your IFR on those over-the-air broadcast signals lots of times, and I'll bet you also own various kinds of step attenuators. WA2RYY, K2RIW, the TechNet. Good question.
What you should have said is I basically answered the question before I asked it, which is actually, I think, what I did. I didn't use a step attenuator, but I did use precision, fairly, I would call them, fairly good precision attenuators, and I have a collection of them that'll give me a total of 47 dB of attenuation, being 75 ohm connectors, F connectors. I'll give an example of what I did, so we'll just figure this backwards, Dick. I took RF channel 3 because I wanted to do low band, high band, and UHF. On RF 3, I had to put 47 dB of attenuation in before I start to attempt to make the picture block. That's on RF channel 3. Let's see, on RF channel 7, I had to put 43 dB of attenuation before I could convert it to not see the picture anymore, where at the point of breakup. RF 13, I only took 32 dB of attenuation. That's interesting. Let's see, let's take a nice BQHF channel. Channel 30, it took 35 dB of attenuation to make that channel go away. And I have a higher UHF channel, channel 40. It took also about 30 dB of attenuation to make that channel go away. So to answer my own question, what I did after I noticed these attenuation factors with a converter,
you know, those numbers are meaningless without the original value of each individual channel because you don't receive them at the same level.
Let me finish what I was going to say. I know what the attenuation factor was, and I looked at the pilot carrier because I don't have these. My analyzer will not measure the 6 megahertz accurately. It's a service monitor. What I did was I looked at the pilot carrier on each of these and wrote down that level and that is fairly accurate on each particular channel. The strongest signal I got was channel 3, minus 46 dBm, and over measuring 50 ohms compared to 75 ohm system, it's going to be a little different, but not too much though. So on our channel 3, I got a reading of minus 46 dBm. RF7, I got a reading of minus 54. RF13, I got a reading of minus 60. Let's see, RF30, I got a reading of minus 56 dBm. So, I subtracted the attenuated values from the apparent signal level values I had been measuring, and that gave me the effective sensitivity that the converter had issued very repeatedly from low band, high band of UHF to around minus 95, 94, 95, 96 dBm of sensitivity. Below that, the converter wouldn't see the picture. Above that, it would be see the picture in most cases.
Yeah, the question I've got for Eric, though, and he's given us a warning on this. You and I, Joe, would like to believe that the pilot tone, 300 and some odd KC up from the low end on the digital television signal, is a standard amplitude compared to the rest of the signal. Eric has been telling us in the past that that is a derived signal that could have a significant number of decibels of amplitude error compared to the rest of the signal. Is that still true, Eric? Is that pilot tone a little bit arbitrary in its relative strength compared to the rest of the bars, the haircut, if you know what I mean, the rest of the information, the rest of the energy in that 6-meg channel? Are we going wrong to use the pilot tone as an amplitude reference? KE2EJ, K2RAW.
K2RAW, KE2EJ. Well, look, I mean, if you want to be really laboratory precision, you want to be measuring symbols, you know? But you can't do that with a mistake analyzer. Although if you had a digital signal analyzer, you can do it pretty easily. You can do that any day. Much better way of doing it. But the point of the matter is that it all depends upon the manufacturer who wrote the software for that particular exciter. There's variation within, you know, a half a dB, so I mean, it's not a precision reference. It's supposed to be a specific value. I don't have it in front of me, but I can get the actual value of the next element. Or for sure, a tolerance. So, nothing is precise. The only thing you have to be careful is precise are the filters that prevent you from going outside the edges of the band.
Okay, now, your definition of broadcast precision and our definition as ham radio operators, where we're trying to find out is it rape or murder? Is it fish or fowl? I mean, to the nearest couple of dB for what Joe is doing would almost satisfy him.
The only thing to do with that is that you got to be sure you're not looking at the effect of any kind of multipath, because, you know, it can make it appear smaller than it actually is.
Oh, yeah, we've got a great... In other words, the digital television demodulator can drop out because of multipath, even though it's got lots of amplitude. We know we've got that variable there. But you made it sound like, from channel to channel, the relative amplitude of that pilot can easily have half a dB of error. But if I'd like to say I can tolerate a dB of error of relative amplitude of that pilot tone, could I make a guess that 90% of the respective FCC licensed television overseas?
Absolutely.
All right, so I can trust them to the nearest half a dB. Is that a reasonable approximation, Eric Glad?
It's reasonable, but, you know, when you're talking about over the air and a distance, you can create whatever standard you want, but, you can make an assumption that it's a good reference to make a measurement. You'll find that the actual stuff that the HP stuff that they sent out with doing all the automated measurements of transmissions from the World Trade Center actually does a couple different things. It does an average, it does a peak, it does a minimum, it does a maximum, and then mathematically they extrapolate all that.
Okay, so it looks like we've re-derived, Joe. We've made progress here. From time to time, I've heard Eric tell me, don't depend on the amplitude of that pilot tone. Looks like a little bit of that's been subtracted tonight. Looks like to the nearest half a dB or so, I can depend on the relative amplitude of the pilot tone. Now your biggest variable is whether or not your particular digital television demodulator on that particular RF channel is dropping out, not because of weakness of signal strength, but because of multipath and symbol distortion problems. If you're willing to wave your antenna back and forth in azimuth while making the sensitivity measurement, a little bit of that digital symbol distortion causing your bit error rate of your digital demodulator to drop out, a little bit of that can be subtracted by choosing the most desirable television aerial aiming for that particular channel. And sometime in the near future, I'm going to be mounting my television in receiving aerial with its azimuth rotator at the at a nice level of a tower, and I'll be joining you in some of these experiments. W2RY, great experiment. K2RIW in the 10 man. You got a joke.
You know, it really helps when you can generate the signal and actually have it come out of the end of the beam of cable.
Yeah.
We all don't own that kind of test equipment.
I know somebody we can borrow it from if we twist his arm just right. Over to you, Aaron.
No, it would have to be, you would have to come to me because it's on the air all the time, but you can pass it off before it actually leaves the antenna.
Okay, so we'll have to bring Mohammed to the mountain, the mountains in Plainview. So it looks like we have access to that test equipment in order to do a confirmation of your over-the-air measurements, Joe. W2RYY, K2RIW. That's an attractive invite, by the way.
With what you just said, and you tap the signal off a particular point off your transmitter, how do you know that the cable converter, the digital converter box is not seeing direct radiated energy from the antenna at the same time?
He shields to the nearest 130 dB. Go to you, Eric.
What is it he was asking?
He's worried that the leakage measurements in the laboratory where the transmitter is located, where you're going to be tapping, he's worried that the signal radiated through the air getting into his converter is going to have an effect on the tap point where you think you're sampling some of the signal that's going up the tower. He's worried about the sneak path. And I just said that, well, you've got 130 dB of shielding, that's not a problem. K2HA,
K2LAW. By the way, the antennas don't radiate down. They radiate out. But yeah, you know, the building is too much cell phone when we work in the building. And the cell tower is right outside on the tower. Plus, if you've ever looked at any of the tuners and the way they're built, not to let any RF leak in anyway. But, you know, that's all part of the point.
Yeah, Joe does have a valid point, though. I could be using a tri-band or a six-element Yagi on 20 meters, aiming that signal out to the horizon. And I want to operate a receiver in the same shack with me with that transmitter. And I've done a real good job of making sure that all the coax connectors are installed correctly and they're all screwed down tight and whatever. And the leakage of your own transmitter in your shack getting into your own receiver will override the living daylights out of it in the sideband mode. You'd like to put on those earphones and you'd like to think you're going to be able to hear the quality of the signal you're transmitting out of the antenna. It's not so easy. So because a receiver has a... In the case of a sideband receiver, which has got a sensitivity of minus 120 dBm, but you might be transmitting plus 50 dBm, 100 watts, that's 180 dB of power spread, and nobody's got 180 dB of shielding. So you're going to be hearing your own leakage signal in your own shack. That's the amateur radio experience, and your broadcast center is radiating a zillion watts. Even if you've got 130 dB of shielding, I think he's got a reasonable worry there about he might have to do some auxiliary shielding or putting some anechoic material around the sides of his digital converter while he taps it into your spot to make sure he's really measuring the direct soup and not getting the spill, if you know what I mean. KE2EJ, K2LIW.
Well, sounds like you're trying to make a deal. Super looking to a scientific study, yeah. And the simplest thing to do is you put a terminator on the transmitter. Listen to the frequency and see if you get anything. If you don't get anything, you don't get any indication on the meter. I don't think you got much to worry about. So, at what point do you begin to worry.
Yes, if you terminate it and the thing picks up to your station full signal,
okay, I'll go.
Yeah, you've got some interference here. But I'm pretty darn sure that just about every receiver, because I've tried it, that I've tried it on. You could have converted, put a terminator on the end of it. It's like, dang, nothing there.
Dick, I'm going to make another comment with this whole measurement thing.
Yeah, it's a beautiful educational process we're going through here, Eric. So, I mean, Joe. Go ahead, Joe.
On every television channel measures, and you know what kind of antenna system I have, I want 23s plus and minus of center alignment for New York City, which is, to me, about 270 degrees. I went from 290 to 250 at picture breakup, just to make sure I wasn't getting a little bit of multipath, and it pretty much corresponded to the center board of the antenna. Here's an interesting thing I did notice, though. Without any attenuation on some of the channels, I could turn the antenna away, and I guess because of multipath, even though the signal level was there on the pilot carrier, the pitch would go away, and it'd be well above the apparent converter's sensitivity level that I measured previously, like a signal minus 85, minus 90 dBm. But if I was not aimed at the center of the target, you know, the bore, the antenna, so to speak, at the transmitter, and went 20, 25 degrees off, definitely dropped out, even though I had signal there, according to measuring the pilot carrier. I can still see the other noise in the rest of the channel, too, so that does seem to make a pretty good size difference in the measurements and also the reception. But I did this basically just to know what the sensitivity is, to know what I'm playing with here. Back to you.
He's missing something very important.
I'm going to guess that when he aims far away and he continues to get the television picture, he's getting it as a reflection of a water tower, so to speak. And so at various places, he's going to be getting the direct and indirect, and the poor converter is going to say, I give up. Go ahead, Eric, K2EJ, K2RIW.
Guys, I'll make a deal. I'll come over with a piece of equipment that actually shows you what the equalizer is doing in the tune. Okay. And as you rotate the antenna and you see what's happening to the tap within the tuner as you move the antenna, the correlation that's missing right now that you can't see because you're only dealing with data input that you can actually touch and smell right now. I'm talking about something that you have no way of looking at, but once you see this data, it's going to change your view or change the way you look at this whole thing.
If I understand correctly, you're describing what we in the military world call the transversal filter. It is the digital equivalent of a delay line with a whole bunch of taps. And as you adjust the positive and negative polarity and the relative amplitudes of all of those taps that all go into a summing point before you now look at the data into your receiver. In theory, if you've got enough taps and enough delay line, you can now cancel a hell of a lot of multipath and echoes and whatever. And so my next question is going to be, if you bought a digital television converter made 10 years ago, 5 years ago, 1 year ago, I'm guessing that the degree of difference in that so-called transversal filter, which you're calling equalizer, I think from brand to brand and model to model, I suspect that the amount of capability of that function could be significantly different. KE2EJ, K2RIW, the tech man.
The description and the assumption is 100% correct. Okay, actually, the device that I would bring over is the third generation, equivalent to a third generation equalizer. The newest TVs that have either fifth or seventh generation equalizer, they have quite considerably different behaviors than actually when you look at a set with a seventh generation equalizer, if you're in an area where you've got a reasonably strong signal, start swinging your antenna around, you may find that there's no place where the signal goes away. So, you know, that's how good it's getting. But, you know, there's still issues there. But, just to correlate the error rate, the amount of work that the variable delay line in essence is doing, and what you see on a spectrum analyzer in terms of the shape of the signal and the little pilot, when you see that that all work together, your view of this whole thing changes.
Now, I see a little bit of a problem here, Eric. Your piece of test equipment, which either does have a third or a seventh generation equalizer, and you can look at the display screen and look at what each of those taps is doing in polarity and magnitude on your piece of test equipment. But you don't have all of those taps into that delay line of his particular converter. Therefore, you're not quite sure what his converter is doing or how much capability it has. Could it equal the stealthiness of your third generation or your seventh generation equalizer that's in your piece of test equipment? We can do a side-by-side comparison, and you can find out whether or not your piece of test equipment would have dropped out or transmitted that signal to the screen, but his particular television digital receiver may act a little bit differently than that. Am I wrong on that one, Eric? KE2EJ, KE2LAW?
I think you're missing the point, KC. I'm trying to get across something that's human. It's not mathematical. It's not anything. It's a feeling. It's an understanding. It's an engineer taking his unknown innate, this certain magical something inside you that you get when you observe the way something occurs. And when you have that kind of sense, when you're looking at something where there's an unknown, but you have to kind of imagine what's going on there, at least when you get a little sense of what something can do and the principle upon which it does it, and you feel it, it gives you a sense. I'm not looking for empirical data here. I'm just trying to get a feeling across. You understand what I'm trying to say. So the observer can have a little more of an intuitive sense, let's say.
You're giving us some good, accurate information, Eric. But is there a simple way that I can understand this one? If I took a third-generation equalizer and look at it with your particular piece of test equipment, and now I took the latest and greatest whiz-bang television set for $1 zillion that I can buy that's got a seventh generation or an eighth generation equalizer. Does that seventh generation equalizer, does it have more tap points? Does it have more dynamic range of the tap points? Does it have a better algorithm to know how to adjust those tap points? Can it adjust those tap points in the real time domain more rapidly? What makes a seventh generation equalizer compared to a third generation equalizer? I know there's no exact answer. Give me a rough feeling for what's happening there, Eric. KE2EJ, KE2LAW.
Okay. I know where you're going, and I can actually give you an answer to what you're really looking for. First of all, having the third generation device, I can use that as a comparative reference. So, you know, I can turn the antenna at some particular point, and the equalizer goes out of its mind and says, I ain't doing this anymore, and I can stick that same signal into the other set that washed up fine and says, hey, I'm very happy and it had good error rates. So I can extrapolate some ideas from that. Yeah, I can use that as a comparative tool. But the specifics of what you're asking, I mean, does it work better? Yeah, I mean, that's a good answer to start with. But where I answer the question of what is it, the difference between this one and that one, okay, if I'm looking for the precise answer, I mean, I can always go and look at the research papers and the white papers that they give when they announce the product, because it's being made not for just one company, but for everybody, so, you know, the concept is put out there. But the one thing, now let me let it drop and I'll get into the reason, what the real advance is. The one thing that puts each generation ahead of the previous generation, and it's a very strange concept, it's the ability to look ahead. It's to look for a pre-ghost, for a ghost that didn't happen. And the third generation equalizer, I think the amount that it went out was only 25 microseconds or 30 microseconds. I forget what the exact value is. The next generation, it goes out a little further. The next generation goes out a little further. A little increment step, but those little increment steps provide, you know, dBs of improvement in the end result of that little bit of step. You know, it's a whole nother 2 hours if we're going to get into the pre-ghost discussion that we had a couple of years ago, if you remember.
This is good information, and I'm going to make some guesses as to what's going on here. I'm going to guess that a seventh generation that can look more microseconds ahead possibly has a longer delay line, a higher quality delay line, more taps, and a better
thinking analog.
Okay. How do you take a multipath signal that's arriving at different amounts of time without doing the digital equivalent of a delay line with taps, a transversal filter, to cancel?
Don't do it analog. You know, it's another flip-flop he's doing along the way. That's another multiply and add.
Okay, so I use as many flip-flops as I want to make a digital delay line, but I've got taps on those, and as I use a longer digital delay line with more flip-flops and more taps, and as I use those taps more intelligently with a more anticipatory algorithm, is that where the smart is for the seventh generation? That's question number one. And question number two, I hope all of this is being made public domain, so to speak. There isn't, say, but some particular company out there holding this real close to his chest, thinking it's proprietary and keeping it a secret from everybody else. He did give me some words that made it sound like everybody is sharing all this information so that we all get pulled up together. KE2EJ, K2LIW.
K2LIW, K2EJ. Well, there's a number of different things that go on. There are groups of companies that work together to develop newer versions of what currently is. That's like HDSD, M&H. All the current stuff is available for your reading pleasure at ATSC.org, and the actual electrical specifications and the actual packet layout and specifications in a document known as A.52. And you'll see there's a whole lot of other informational dockets there for your reading pleasure. All the specifications are spelled out in terms of the mathematics of how everything works, how the transmission system is put together, how the turbine is even laid out. And even the randomizer. So there's no detail from this document you can create. K2RW, K2EJ.
If Jim and I go out and buy a television set today, and how many frames per second, how many lines, oh, these are some of the variables, whether or not it's got a 62-inch screen or a 32-inch screen, these are some of the variables, and whether or not it's a liquid crystal or some other kind of display, these are some of the variables that make the difference in price. However, there is no good way that you and I can look at the specifications of a set that you're about to buy to know whether or not you're getting a third generation or a seventh generation equalizer. Is there any way you know of that I can make sure that if the thing that's important to Joe and I is how well that equalizer can eliminate multipath? Is there a simple way that I can find out if I buy a JVC brand name television set, model number so-and-so, whether or not I'm getting a good equalizer or a not-so-good equalizer? I'm a little bit worried that that's not easy to get a hold of that information, because no normal consumer has enough smarts to ask that question is one possible solution here. KE2EJ, K2LIW, and are you getting close to touchdown?
I'm in my driveway again, it doesn't matter. Look, previous generations usually have run out of any, and I wouldn't really worry about that. Actually, all TV sets, they do publish specifications. I forget what you call it, the Lockwave specification. There's the giveaways in there. That number gets better with the higher generation equalizer. But, you know, if you're going to the store today, I would not worry that you're going to buy a third generation equalizer if you're buying a Panasonic or a Samsung or something like that. They've long stopped using those chips.
So when it comes to the generation of the equalizer, am I worrying unnecessarily? Almost everything is fairly, what's the word, equalized. Has all of that variable of the equalization function essentially settled out? Have they stopped working on that function to your knowledge, Eric? KE2EJ, KQRIW.
Well, interesting you should ask that, because ATSC 3.0 is somewhere around the corner, and there are multiple different RF methodologies, one or two of them, I think, that are backwards compatible, that actually relies on improved abilities to be able to pick up what exists. So, yeah, I would say that research continues on that front, because the concept of the new ATSC 3 is that you should be able to carry Ultra HD and it be sort of format agnostic, so if anything that comes down the road in the future, we're not stuck like we are now.
As we go to 7th generation, 8th, 9th generation, or whatever, will we ever get to the point where over-the-air digital, over-the-air broadcast digital television has anything close to the range that used to exist on analog television? There were people in the analog days with a reasonably good antenna and a little bit of a tower alongside of the house in Southampton that were watching over-the-air broadcasts from New York City. We don't get half that range today. I'll admit that their standards are a little bit different. They could tolerate quite a bit of snow and ghost, but still, as we get to these higher generations, will some of that range of digital television that we seem to have lost, will some of it come back to your knowledge, Eric? KE2EJ, KQLAW.
Well, if I could change the laws, I could get you that back tomorrow. I could get you back in double and triple and double. That's an amazing thing. Well, there are certain things about multipath that, you know, you have all the power you want, it's going to help you. That's why the newer standards are more, well, the LFM is way more multipath power. What did I know of this? Every methodology, and it's all mathematics. You know, that's pluses and it's minuses, what can I tell you?
Well, you said something up very interesting there, Eric. If my equalizer has enough stealth and cunning, is there a level of multipath and a number of simultaneous multipath paths beyond which an ideal equalizer cannot find a solution? Where's the limit? If I've got a really good modern-day equalizer, can it tolerate 3 simultaneous multipaths, 5 simultaneous multipaths, particularly where the multipaths might be close to the same amplitude, but all kinds of yucky number of nanoseconds and microseconds of delay? Where is the threshold of grief where equalization with enough intelligence behind it cannot hack it? KE2EJ, KQRIW.
Now, the long and short answer to that is it's dollars. It's all about dollars. I mean, you know, you take a look at some of the FPGAs, you could make, you know, 128-bit DSP then. Sometimes I was playing one the other day. Stupid chip question. 186 bucks, right? One chip! Yeah, we could make really good stuff using the simple algorithm that we have, as long as we've got to work with. So, you know, either you custom design a chip and try and bring it within the realm of making a portable TV that you can sell for $59. Yeah, sure, why not? But you know, you get something to limiting you to control it up to change.
I'll admit that when you make this super expensive set that you and I are proposing here, that only a small percentage of the population is going to buy it. But just like Star Trek, we thought NBC television didn't think anybody's really watching Star Trek. And it turns out in reruns it made a hell of a lot more money at times, $1 million per showing as a rerun. In other words, we suddenly found out how valuable it was. You design a set with a deep enough equalizer, and even though that set is an extra $100, there's a lot of people you and I can mention right now with the sound of our voice that will pay that money to get that performance. So if somebody will make the leap of faith of building that very expensive chip, which is going to be expensive at first, but with mass production, it's going to get cheaper. that set will eventually sell, Eric. That's my opinion. KE2EJ, K2LAW.
All right, well, you're the one that always talks about not seeing any antennas.